your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make the heaven the middle of it. Rest make the heaven the middle. We are. Rest make the heaven the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. With me tonight is Tony Godling from Bristol, England. Welcome back, Tony.
Hi, George.
Okay, man, there's a lot going on. We had the shooting here. I guess you followed that some. And in England, there's no parliament yet, is there? Do we know?
Well, there is a parliament just, but we've had a what they call a hung parliament, which means that there's no overall majority. So politically, Theresa May should be history, right? So she has called a general election on the basis which she didn't need to do, 3 years ahead of time, right?
Right.
I mean, you have to laugh because it's so ridiculous that anybody could have any confidence in her whatsoever. She should really be, at this stage, a backbencher. I mean, she clearly has got absolutely no ability to lead anything because she's led the country into this general election. She's led the Tory party into an embarrassing defeat. So they've lost their majority in the House of Commons. That means they can't pass legislation at all without the support of the Democratic Unionist Party in Northern Ireland, some of whom are ex-paramilitaries on the loyalist side, you know, the anti-republican, anti-Catholic side, and the Orange Order dominates the DUP. Also worth mentioning it that the Conservative Party is also known as the Conservative and Unionist Party. Now that is a reference to the DUP, effectively, saying that it's one party. But this has been, it's been pretended, I think, for a long time that they're two separate parties. Actually, they're very close. I think it's pretty clear that the DUP is a Masonic party. I mean,
it is. Oh, man.
All but name. Well, you have a look at the Orange, basically all of the people who are running that party are Orange Order supporters. They're also supporters of the Ian Paisley Church that he created called the Free Presbyterian Church.
Right.
And they're very religious, but then they're also quite puritanical. So they're not, shall we say, lovey-dovey, huggy religious or happy-clappy at all. They're very sort of austere, a bit morose, kind of dour, if you want. But anyway, so they have also, the DUP have come straight from their own scandal, which has closed down the Stormont Parliament in Northern Ireland. That happened last year, but it was because the Democratic Unionist Party had been, basically they'd taken £500 million of public money and they'd been giving it to their mates. So they'd been running this scheme for energy efficiency, but they'd been discriminating against Catholics. This is the sort of thing that's been going on for literally 400 years in Northern Ireland, possibly even more. And it was at the roots, the discrimination at the roots of the Northern Ireland Troubles in the 1970s, 80s and 90s. So this is not looking good for an even-handed government in Northern Ireland to have these guys now holding the balance of power in Westminster.
Oh, my God, the Brits won't do that, will they?
Well, that is what's got to happen. I mean, Theresa May and the Conservative Party, their majority relies on these 10 MPs from Ireland. Well, look, George, it's not the first time that Irish MPs have held the balance of power at Westminster. And it doesn't give them total power, but it gives them a power much, much greater than the size of the party and the number of seats. So they've only got 10 seats in a 700, 600 MP Parliament. But
right.
Their power is much greater. Now, if you go back, I love this history stuff. I hope you don't mind me indulging myself with it. But if you go back to the 1800s, to the 19th century, the 1880s, there was a big dispute in Ireland with the Captain Boycott, if you remember, that's where the word comes from, boycotts going on.
Okay.
Of the rich Protestant landowners were being boycotted by all the population there because of things like the famines. Now, the famines were where the food just simply wasn't being distributed to Catholics in Catholic areas. And, of course, there was the potato blight as well helping. But, I mean, what they were effectively doing was using the potato blight as a way of channeling people onto migrant ships over to the good old USA.
Right. A lot of them came here because of the potato famine.
That's right. And but the thing is that it was a kind of confected thing because the people were being starved. Good food was being carted out of Ireland to England, whilst people who were actually in Ireland, they were watching it as they were starving, being carted past them. So it was a very sectarian thing. Queen Victoria was basically racist, you know. She was very anti the Catholics, as, of course, has been, you know, part of most of the Protestant world. And, you know, a lot of William Shakespeare's plays are based on this anti-Catholic bias. I mean, he was very pro-Catholic himself, and he was, you know, I don't know if he was actually a Catholic, but he was writing in days when it was a terrible thing to be a Catholic, and yet it was a kind of almost like sort of a bit like during the early days of the church with Jesus and his friends. You know, it was quite cool to be this part of this underground movement. And Shakespeare was, you know, whilst the Protestants were persecuting the Catholics. So, you know, that's effectively what was going on in Ireland too. So you've got this persecution and starvation and deliberate starving of millions of people in Ireland. And so that's what effectively the DUP is, the modern kind of equivalent of these types of people. I'm not saying they're quite so drastic, but of course all this discrimination did well up in the 1970s because the way that that Northern Ireland was being managed by the Protestants to make sure that the Catholics had no good houses, they had no good jobs, they had no access to things like bank loans or whatever if they wanted to, you know, start a business. It was a very discriminatory place. In fact, they found it very, very difficult even to be allowed to vote. And that's what caused through the civil rights movement in the 1960s, really, you know, and it was the British Parachute Regiment shooting into unarmed demonstrators in the early 1970s, what they call Bloody Sunday, that sparked off the troubles. And, you know, I'm not saying this is all going to, you know, be rekindling this, but it does mean that it's quite clear to the Catholics and the Republicans, the nationalist movement in Ireland, that the Protestants again are in the ascendant, and the DUP are in the ascendant. What does this actually mean for people? Well, a lot of people are questioning Sinn Féin, which is the political wing of what was the Republican movement, the Irish Republican Army. And Sinn Féin has got, I think it's now 6 MPs, but they never go to Westminster. So they're elected, but they never take up their seats. It'd be quite interesting to see if those Sinn Féin MPs were to take, because they've got every right to take up their seats, if they were to change their mind and just this time say, oh, we're going to take up our seats now. They have every legal right to do it. That would throw a real spanner in the works for Theresa May. But, I mean, the main thing is, how is the Northern Ireland going to be able to govern itself again? And I just hope that they're able to reinstitute the Stormont Parliament. So there's a lot of sort of minutiae of Irish politics, which I hope, you know, I think important to explain that it's not really a religious dispute. It's much more a kind of incoming, a bit like Palestine, really. You've got an incoming community who use religion as a way to sort of beat their fellow man and to say, well, you know, actually, you're a different lot to us. And you know, that isn't really what religion is about. It's about being kind and peaceful. It's not about invading people, taking their land, stealing their land, and bullying them around. So, you know, they're two different communities. I mean, we even have things like in the places like Glasgow, Liverpool. You know, you've got the two football teams. You've got the Catholic football team and the Protestant football team. You know, usually one is green and the other one red, you know, whatever. But, you know, that is a bit of a divide. And I lived over in Northern Ireland for a while during the Troubles and saw it for myself, because I was reading bulletins on the BBC here in Britain and thinking to myself, I don't understand these words, you know, unionist, Catholic, loyalist, UVF, UFF, IRA, Republican, you know, who is doing what, nationalist, who is doing what, and, you know, what are the divides? So effectively you've got a potential powder keg still in Northern Ireland, but you know, I'm just hoping that we'll see a bit of leadership from Jeremy Corbyn to show just how useless Theresa May is, because she is effectively a dead woman walking. She really is. I mean, because she's made such a mess of this, calling this general election for herself, for her party, for Brexit. And my big suspicion, George, I don't know what you think, is that the general election was actually confected by the super elite, because they don't want the what was the previous version of the Tory party to have a hard Brexit and a complete.
Yeah, I think they're afraid of Brexit. They're afraid they're against that. Yeah.
Yeah, and of course Theresa May has gone along with this stupidly, like a zombie, and she's paid the price. But she's still the Prime Minister, which is unbelievable. I mean, she went along to just after the general election to see the Queen, but she went. She took her husband with her. Her husband is a multi-millionaire, billionaire. Some say he's a investment fund manager. Works with this company called Capital Group, who are based in Los Angeles, and I would imagine the Queen is actually much more interested in chatting with him than with Theresa May. So he wears the trousers effectively, and he really is just telling Theresa May what to do, I think.
Oh man, it's sort of behind the scenes, right?
Yeah, it's a bit like somebody like Henry Kissinger trying to nag Donald Trump.
Yeah, I tell you, boy. You know, they're getting serious about removing Trump now with the you know, obstruction of you know, justice charges.
Well, wasn't it, you know, I'm just thinking about Jeff Sessions, when he was being accused of, basically treachery. It was so much like the McCarthyite witch hunt trials from the 1950s. I mean, I wasn't alive at the time, but you see recordings of these sessions. You know, were you ever a member of the Communist Party? Have you associated with the Communist? You know, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Is exactly what we're getting right now. And, of course, it was Arthur Miller, wasn't it, who was, I think it was Marilyn Monroe's fella for a while. I don't know if they were married. Were they married?
Yeah, I think it was her boyfriend, yeah.
It was his play, The Crucible, which I think, you know, I don't know if they're still teaching it, but every school kid should study this play.
Yeah.
And actually, it's a brilliant, fun play to enact it out, because you have this, I saw Jeff Sessions with the devil. I've seen Jeff Sessions with the devil. But it's this kind of, this disease mentality where there really isn't any evidence, strong evidence to suggest these things. But you've got a witch hunt going on. That's
well, you know, they don't even need much to impeach a president if they can get the votes in the House and Senate.
See? So, I mean, have these hearings of Jeff Sessions been taking place in Salem, Massachusetts?
Done what now?
Were the hearings taking place in Salem, Massachusetts?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the witch trial. Well, you know, he testified before Congress the other day and came off pretty well.
Yes, I think he did. And I don't know if it's going to wash this, but certainly there is an attempt to get Trump. It was really interesting to see, literally 3 days after the close of the Bilderberg conference, was the first serious move to impeach the president.
Terrence McAuliffe. Remember he was on Bilderberg meetup
list? Yeah.
Well, he's the governor of Virginia. Now, he's slated for, he got the blessings to be elevated now. And he may be the next president of the United States in 2020.
Well, we shall see.
Yeah.
Certainly, the fact that he's appeared at Bilderberg suggests he might be. But, you know, I think we've got a frightening government now, because I don't know what you think, George, as an ex-military man, but it looks to me as if Trump has taken a back seat when it comes to foreign policy now, and he's letting basically Exxon run the show through Rex Tillerson, and he's really ceding policy to James Mattis, you know, Mad Dog Mattis, the butcher of Fallujah, over. And I noticed just the other day, even Human Rights Watch is criticising them for these phosphorus bomb attacks last week in Iraq and in Syria. What the hell are they doing? This is, everybody knows this stuff is illegal under international law. These are war crimes. You don't use white phosphorus.
I saw that, yeah. They used it over there. Yeah.
Certainly not in civilian areas where there's been very little coverage of it. This is the thing.
Well, the Israelis were using it in Gaza.
Well, you just imagine if the Russians were to be using it.
Gosh,
it would be the main news for a week on the top of the headlines and the front pages. But because it's the US using it and Mattis. But I wonder what you think, George, about you know, whether Trump has taken, as it looks like he has,
North Korea's dead. We're not going to attack. I don't know who made that change, but we pulled back our task forces already.
So I'll tell you what happened is that the new South Korean president has told them to go home.
Well, they shipped that poor student back in a coma.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that crazy? I mean, they induced something, gave him something to induce a problem, you know, neurological problem, and then shipped him back on a plane. We flew him out of there, you know, but he's in a coma still.
But look, I mean, this is all interesting, but the Middle East is really where it's at, and Israel policy. I mean, seems to me most of our policy in the Middle East, that is Britain and America's policy, is framed around Israeli-US interests. And I wonder what you make of the use of white phosphorus. Is that something you think is just Mattis deciding? Because, of course, he used it in Fallujah. I don't know if Trump even knows it's been used.
It shouldn't be used at all. You know, it's prohibited. I mean,
would Trump be signing that off, or is he just said to his generals, you get on with the war?
The problem with Trump is that he's an authoritarian personality type, and he defaults to these guys in uniform on stuff like that. And they want to use what they've got available. Okay.
Well, that's quite feasible. You know, you've got, I think it was the Syrian ambassador who I interviewed last week. He's a former UK ambassador to Syria, a guy called Peter Ford. And he's very outspoken about what's happened over there. In fact, he had an attack on his life while he was the ambassador, where the Syrian police shot dead these various jihadis who come over from, they think, from Iraq to try and kill him in his ambassador's residence. And he was describing that pretty frightening episode. But he had every respect for the Syrian government. He said these guys, you know, they basically put their lives at risk to look after him. They did a really good job in you know, basically taking out this squad of jihadis with rocket-propelled grenades, kind of bazooka things, to try and blow him up in his residence, and they took him down. Basically, they took him out, you know. And but he's also one of the people. Sounds like you, like similar to what you're saying that when it comes to uniforms, Trump never said no to a man in a uniform.
Right. I've seen kids Palestinian kids in the Gaza that got hit with that phosphorus stuff, and it burns right through them. It's terrible wounds.
Well, what it does is it actually feeds off human flesh, effectively. It goes into one side of the person, and it reacts with human flesh, and it actually becomes more hot and burning and dangerous, and then it kind of goes into the next person. I mean, it really is. It's evil stuff.
It's very evil.
It's like, yeah, it's a kind of a living hell, basically.
It is. It's an evil system, you know, explosive.
Yeah. I mean, I would also compare it to the use of white phosphorus in, I think it was 2004, by Mattis in Fallujah, as well as the use by the Brits too of depleted uranium over in Iraq.
I know.
When we've been using these countries as a total dumping ground and flaunting international law. And of course, it's talking of international law. It's exactly 50 years since the Six-Day War at the moment. That's just over, in fact. But that was one of the most important conflicts in history, because it really was even just a few years after the end of the Second World War. There's been some really good articles on it. I don't know if you've been checking them out, George, on the Six Day War, but it just to show, for example, that the whole thing, there was a great thing on The Intercept with one of their correspondents on Glenn Greenwald.
Well, the Israelis initiated the war. They attacked.
That's right. And the myth was supposed to be that Israel was under threat, blah, blah. Actually, the truth of the
matter... They said they were surrounded by the Arab forces and they just had to attack. That's the reason. But then they took out the Liberty. Remember, they almost sank the Liberty?
That's right. Well, wasn't it a sort of minor miracle that the Liberty didn't actually sink?
The guy that was on board there that survived, one of the survivors, I interviewed him years ago. You know what happened? He started crying on my program. He was so emotionally, distraught about the Liberty. He lost his best friend. There was a bulkhead on one side where the torpedo hit. It took out his best friend, and he was on the other side and lived. And he had become an alcoholic, and he was a preacher at the time that I interviewed him, and he broke down and cried on my program. I mean, well, it's very emotional.
I think the reason people do that is because they're there, risking their lives for their country, and their country doesn't give a damn about them.
That's right. I met a man, one of our ASA surveillance operators on the top of a mountain in Africa, okay, Asmara, and they were intercepting all the communications, and they had Hebrew linguists up there, English and everything. And they saw the whole thing unfold, and they were, privy to the witnessing of the attack by the Israelis.
Yeah, I mean, the Six-Day War is a bit of a misnomer, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because this war is still going on. It's endured for 50 years. It was the biggest land grab. I mean, something like trebled the size of the Israeli state, basically land grabbing. And
That's what they're
saying?
Yeah.
They say it's a holy land grab. That's what they
say.
Well,
Miko Peled, his father, General Peled, was one of the heroes of the Six-Day War. And after the war he was consulting with Parliament in Israeli, and he withdrew his support for the government because he said that's what they were doing. They were pushing out the Palestinians and grabbing the land.
And the so-called hero general of the Israelis, Moshe Dayan, famously said, Israel should be like a mad dog, too dangerous to bother. And I'm afraid that is the U.S.-Israeli and to a similar extent,
well, there,
British.
There have been people that have written about the Israeli lobby and their dominance of our politics, and they're absolutely right about that. AIPAC and all that are very dominant in the political dominance of our Congress. But they're all working together with our CIA and the Mossad. They're all working together, MI6, you know what I mean. They're all together on these things.
Yeah, but you see, there is a narrative, a growing narrative, that understands this. I mean, looking at, for example, Netanyahu's book from the 1980s, Terrorism, How the West Can Win. Right, so he's edited this book. In fact, he did a chapter of his own,
right,
Benjamin Netanyahu, saying that, well, we've got these problems with these Arab terrorists, and this is how you beat them. Effectively, what they were saying was, let's institute this British, what was originally a British policy, which is the counter-gang policy. So what you do is you set up fake cells of these terrorists that you want to overwhelm. And those fake cells then go out carrying out the most appalling atrocities, and you use that to discredit the entire terrorist uprising, wherever it happens to be, whether it's Kenya. The British were doing this with the Mau Mau in Kenya. But what, of course, has happened since is that they're using this whole kind of terrorist meme in order to you see, they're not terrorists anymore, George. What they are is state-sponsored. So the terrorists...
Right.
The trouble is the terrorists are supposed to be these sort of free-acting...
It's just like the Gladio stuff, just similar.
Yeah, freedom fighters, but they're not.
Yeah.
They are actually state-sponsored, and quite often when you're seeing a terrorist attack, what you're seeing is simply a covert action by the British military, the US military, maybe the Germans, this kind of thing. I mean, we had this recently, this German Nazi cell uncovered that was planning an attack in unbelievable, it's that it's got so little coverage, in the Vienna airport in Austria. They were planning a terrorist attack. This is the German army, a Nazi cell within the German army, planning a terrorist attack in Vienna airport, and they'd already smuggled guns in. They'd already arranged for the German army officer, lieutenant, to be smuggled out after the attack, and his fingerprints to be left there to be blamed on because he'd already registered his fingerprints as a Syrian refugee's fingerprints, right?
Oh, man.
So the idea was they were going to leave a trail that was going to lead to it being done by a Syrian. So what they're not stupid. What they do is they make sure that the police, as they're investigating, are with a little trail. They lead them along that trail, and but always pointing towards usually a Syrian or someone that. But at the end of the day, with same as these attacks we've had in Britain, you know, both the London Bridge attack,
right,
you know,
right,
a couple of weeks ago, and the Manchester attack, all of these attacks. Look very much, in fact the one with on Westminster Bridge as well back in March, are all people who are at the top of the MI5 watch list. They're people who have had dealings with MI6 at the top of the MI5 watch list. In other words, the MI5 should have 100% surveillance, and yet somehow they managed to get hire vans without MI5 noticing, leave them in the middle of the street overnight, annoy everybody, make a very big, obvious mess in their local area. They're being reported by the mosques to be banned from mosques. They're being reported to the anti-terrorist hotline, being reported to MI5 directly by people picking up the phone saying, this guy's a nutter, he may do an attack. And what happens? He does his attack. So effectively, MI5 is aiding and abetting, very much like the FBI in the US.
Yeah.
Has been setting up these entrapment operations, where what they do is they give people explosives, they egg them on, they urge them to do an attack, and then of course though they might scratch their heads a bit and say, why are they doing this? And then all of a sudden they find the feds everywhere. They're maybe shot dead. They're so-called terrorists. But the whole point of all of this is really just to forward Israeli foreign policy in the Middle East.
Right.
And they've got this horrible. I mean, this is the thing that goes on. The Jewish fundamentalists, Israeli fundamentalists, Zionist fundamentalists, really, we should call them. They are the most dangerous of all, I think, because they've decided that there's going to be a holy war, that it might be called the Battle of Armageddon or something, but it's going to happen, and God has ordained it. And so any attempt at peace is futile. There's no point in talking peace, because this is inevitable, and it's been fatalistically decreed by God that they're going to have this massive war. And that's why they're not really working for peace. They might talk about it a bit, George, but I don't think there's any real attempt. And they want to just clear the Al-Aqsa Mosque off of the Third Temple site in Jerusalem. And of course, that is going to ignite even more problems. But they hope, I think, to exploit that war. The arms companies do too. And the only trouble is, of course, you've got the Russians very much involved in Syria now. The Russians back again. It was the Soviet Union, but now.
What do you think is going to happen in Syria, Tony? What's going to happen there? It's really.
Well, it's difficult to know, isn't it? Because you've got US bases being set up there. The British army are in there.
I know.
According to the Syrian.
It looks like there's going to be a long, drawn-out settlement. That's what I see.
Well, I don't know if the Russians have got the wherewithal to actually clear them out of Syria. I don't know. Maybe they've just decided that certain parts of Syria they're going to just give them up. I don't know. But certainly they're not going to give up Syria as a whole. They're not going to give up the Tarsus naval base. They're not going to give up the airfields, that sort of thing. So it seems to me that Syria, it's the road to Damascus, isn't it? Getting biblical.
Right, right. God, that's true.
That is where the whole regime change policy bashed its head up against a brick wall.
Yeah. It gets crazy, doesn't it, sometimes?
On the road to Damascus is where it happened.
Road to Damascus, yeah. Man, I tell you.
Okay, so, yeah, but also, I mean, yeah, I mean, we've got here in British politics, we've got, also had this terrible fire in London. I don't know if you've seen
it. Yes, I followed that 24-hour story.
Absolutely horrendous. And it's all caused really by the attempt to privatise. Okay, so this is originally built by local authorities with government money, these big housing blocks, actually built very safe, but this particular block last year was refurbished by a bunch of cowboys. And no insult intended to US cowboys. Cowboys are people that just don't know what they're doing. We're talking about cowboy electricians, cowboy contractors, who take a lot of money, make a lot of profit, and then walk away.
Oh, okay.
And in the electrical systems which were put into this building, there were power surges going on. And it's pretty clear that the fire started in flat 16 on the fourth floor, and it was a fridge next to a window in the guy's kitchen, exploded.
Oh, man.
Okay, so his fridge exploded, the fire brigade turned up. The trouble was the fridge was by the window. It caught fire to the whole window, which is a kind of plastic window. And he obviously had to get out of his flat, but the fire brigade went into that flat. They put the fire out. By which time, though, the fridge fire had caught to the cladding on the outside of the building. Now, the cladding is not, for some reason, this is why I mean cowboys, right? The guys that had fitted this stuff, it was not fireproof. So it was a special sort of insulation designed to keep the flats nice and warm and save people's heating bills.
Right.
But the thing, it was flammable.
Oh, my gosh.
So as the flames came out of this guy's window and the fire brigade, as they're putting the fire out in his flat, so the fire was spreading up the side of the building.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's why we are where we are today. I mean, it's also an area of mass gentrification where they're trying to push the poor people out of these big blocks of flats. And it's raised the issue very high on the agenda in Britain now, as this whole business is people being pushed out. And there's a lot of very articulate local people from that area, Ladbroke Grove, Latimer Road. I mean, it's a great part of London, you know, if you're ever in...
Yeah, gosh.
They're really, I mean, this is where you get a lot of sort of pop stars and cheek by jowl with a lot of migrants. It's a brilliant little part of London, but they're trying to make it just for the rich, and so there will be attempts, I imagine, to smash all these tower blocks down and build luxury flats there. It's gentrification. So that's in the background of all of this.
Oh, man.
But then there's also the aspects of the way the place was managed, because it was a tenant-managed place. Of course, it wasn't all tenants managing it, and the attempt has been to get these places, which were run by local authorities, local councils, and built them, to get them privatised, and it was a stage in order to try and do that. And so they're just simply not competent, George, to manage these. The people on the board of that housing tenant management organisation, they're not competent to employ the contractors. They don't know what they're doing.
They've done
a £10 million refurbishment contract that's ended up burning the whole place to the ground.
Golly. That's just the way it goes sometimes, doesn't it? Yeah, I was looking at the people coming out. There's all kinds of different people living there.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is really clear, the difference between Corbyn and May's visits today to the area. Theresa May arrives with no TV cameras or anything. She just goes and talks to some of the chiefs of the police and the ambulance, and then she's whisked off again. She wouldn't dare come out in public. She'd be lynched by the public around there. They're highly politicised. They've just booted out a Tory MP and brought in a Labour MP in that area of London. And she wouldn't last 5 seconds. She would really have everyone screaming at her. But Jeremy Corbyn, in contrast, was going around chatting with everybody and listening very carefully to what's going to happen. I mean, May wants a public inquiry into this. I don't think we need one. We just need these tower blocks properly managed. No fire alarms, George. Can you believe that?
Massive
tower block with something like 500 people living in it. No fire alarm went off.
No smoke alarms?
No. Well, apparently in some of the individual blocks, there were, in individual people's flats, smoke alarms going off, but that doesn't help you. And, of course, the other problem was that people were told to stay inside. Now, they needed to get out because the whole block was going up in flames, burning from the outside in. That was the problem.
Golly.
And that was next. These blocks were never designed like that. I mean, there shouldn't be anything flammable on the outside of the building, but that was all just installed last year. Now that's left the whole place gutted.
Boy, that's tragedy.
It is, but lessons will be learnt, and it looks like probably something like they may finally announce around about 100 fatalities in that block of flats.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and it's unprecedented, really, in London. Another thing I heard was that the people managing the place had put big bollards in the way, so the fire engines couldn't actually get to the right place to put the fires out. Also, that the fire brigade didn't have these things which you can hold out, that people can jump out from higher up, you know, to land safely.
No, yes.
Well, apparently not, no.
My gosh.
But anyhow, you know, this is all still very much in the, you know, people who are examining what's
there was
going
one
on.
Story that a woman wrapped her baby up in a blanket and threw the baby out from 9 stories.
Well, that's quite feasible, yeah. You know, I just think that this is a part of London which is going to be very angry and will start fighting back immediately against an uncaring government. They were already angry. There were reports back in last November saying, by the tenants in this very same block, saying only a disastrous fire with a big loss of life is going to actually bring the attention onto these incompetent and evil landlords that they deserve. Because they are already really angry. I mean, it's a super politicised area, George. They're very, very articulate. They were threatening letters from the council's legal officers, Kensington and Chelsea's council, demanding that they take some of their comments off the internet, this kind of thing. But they were not taken down.
Right.
But so it's,
too bad.
Yeah, it's a sort of top-down management approach where you don't listen to anybody, and that is just simply no way to run things. You have a listening voice. And that's, I'm afraid, the way Britain's going. You know, top down, the rich super elite just tell the underclass, the Untermensch, what they're going to do. They don't listen.
Oh, my gosh. It's terrible.
Yeah, I think you're getting a similar sort of thing over there, where you get basically people who are pliable put into power, you know, so that the elite can just manipulate them, get them to do whatever they want, you know. So you get people who are just not competent to do the job.
That's
quite clearly what we've seen in this Grenfell Tower, the towering inferno.
Wow, it's tragic. Well, look, Tony, I appreciate your update. And
okay, George. Yep.
And I really, really appreciate it. And we'll get back with you next week. How's that sound?
That sounds great, George.
Okay, Tony.
Hope to speak to you then.
Okay.
All the best. Thanks.
Yep.
Bye.
Good night. That wraps up our report by Tony Gosling from Bristol, England. We want to thank Tony again for bringing us those fine reports about Parliament, the UK Parliament, the problems that Theresa May is running into right now. And so thank you again, Tony Gosling. You're just an excellent reporter out of Bristol, England. This week has been hellacious. We've had the attack on the U.S. congressman on the Bald Diamond on Wednesday morning. And they did play the game Thursday, and they went out on second base and prayed. And there's an individual out of Illinois. They already have his name and everything. I won't go into detail about it. But he was on the left, and he was a supporter of Sanders, Bernie Sanders. And he said some very vicious things about President Trump and Republicans. He had a list, a death list, of about 6 different U.S. representatives that he wanted to go after. So, where are we headed? The left has the Antifa out there. Not that they're part of the Democratic Party or anything, but when Hillary lost this election, it was sort of a surprise to President Trump, but he did win. He went into office. Now, he went in with a promise to clean out or to drain the swamp. Well, that is proving to be very, very difficult because the corruption, the level of corruption in Washington, D.C. and our federal government by these leaders has been dominated more and more over the decades. From the time that they took over our money, you know, the creation of our credit through the Federal Reserve private ownership, we've been just down. I mean, this has just been devastating for America.
And we've seen over the decades a transformation from much more of a individualistic, principle-based, American founding principle-based, to something that resembles a much more collective state, security state. Bernie Sanders would be an indication of the number of people that are into socialism, communism, and even worse, you know. So he had a large following. He had good turnouts. Now, he never had attained the turnouts, though, that President Trump did on the campaign trail. But so what is out there is an underlying middle class to upper middle class, hard-working people. Some have lost their jobs, some are in the rust belts and so forth, but they're still working, even if they have to take menial jobs or whatever is available. They're out there and they're working. They are frustrated by the job market, see. And that's one of the things that President Trump is working hard to bring back. Now, he's not without faults, see. But all of us have faults. None of us are all good or all evil or all good or all bad. There's a mixture in each and every one of us. We may try and have and be well-intentioned all the time about what we want to do or how we want to go about it. But there are also always transgressions that we've committed in our past. And I admit I've had some. I've transgressed and did people wrong. And people have done me wrong. And that creates a lot of resentment and hatred. Well, over decades, especially from the turn of the century forward, and especially when they started taking over our credit, the monopoly of our credit creation, we've had a deteriorating and a debased society, morally, spiritually, politically, monetarily. It used to be in the 50s when I was growing up that one salary could pay and support a family of, you know, two, three, four people. Just a husband and wife, maybe two children, three children. And it only took one income because that one income went a lot further. And the purchasing power of the dollar in the 50s was much greater than it is today. But today we've got a lot more dollars in our pockets, but the purchasing power of each and every dollar has been debased. So the dollar back in the 50s would buy a whole lot more. Prices were a lot lower. Thus, that dollar that you earned back then would go a lot further. So today, what are we going to do in this economics? We've got to stay and support our president. I supported him, and I'm not going to get off not supporting him. We can be critical of our president and still support him. And I think that's what you're seeing from the moderate to conservative, his constituency now. The deep state is always there. We've got these really humongously large intelligence agencies that when I was in Berlin, I was working some of that for these intelligence agencies, but our resources were directed towards the communist, Russian communist, and also in Berlin when I was there in West Berlin, our resources and our collection and our mission were directed towards Stasi, which was the secret state police of East Germany and the East German political machine. And then on the ground we had the Russians there that we were missioned against. So we were looking at all of those different factions. But today, many of those resources, or some of those resources, are being directly towards the domestic enemies of the state, so to speak. And I would say that those are some of the people that are considered to be anti-government, very critical of government, critical of socialism and communism, and not going for the Bernie Sanders support, you know, at all, see. So some of those people are being criticized now by these very, very left-wing, very, very radical, very, very violent Marxist, communist, Maoist type followers on the far left. and they're very young people. Now, they're just get caught up. The young people, some, you know, if you talk to them, they have, you know, well intentioned talk and goals, you know, about what they want to they want to attain. See, but you start probing a little bit deeper, and you find out that they're coming from a secular humanist viewpoint, which is godless, and that's what communism is. They come from a godless, man-centered, which is humanism, sort of a secular humanist type of worldview, and their moral base is not fixed. It's fluctuating all the time, and so you'll talk to them. That I've talked to many students out of the University of Texas here in Austin, and you'll start talking about truth, but to them, truth is relative. So they always say, the ones I've talked to in the past, they say, well, that's your truth, but my truth is this. And so they always differentiate what truth is between your truth and their truth. And what they do basically is they come back from a position of social and moral relativism, and that truth is relative. It's sort of like a situation ethics that they've taught over the years in the schools. It's sort of like the new math that doesn't work. It's sort of like the students that come out of high school with completion, you know, certificates, but they can't even read. See what I mean? There's just so much about this. They come out with no morals. Do anything that feels good. Do your own thing, and anything goes. See. And so then, you know, they can easily say, like one said to me not long ago, one of these millennials, 19 years old, you know, he said, yeah, it's those old white guys that wrote the Constitution. Like, he denigrated it, but he associated with the Constitution with these old white guys, see? Like, yeah, they're no good. They're racist, and they were slave owners, probably. He didn't get into detail. But what I failed to tell him right there on the spot, and it occurred to me later, was he was about 19 years old. At his age, I was working Army Intelligence, Army Security Agency in Germany, West Germany, and my last year in West Berlin. We were right up against the wall there in some of our locations there in West Berlin. We had missions and operations that were right on the wall. And our people saw people getting shot by these East German snipers and the East German army that was guarding the wall. So I didn't go back to him and say, look, you're just a little 19-year-old whippersnapper. You don't know a damn thing about what's going on out there. And here you are bringing up this one. You learned it from someone else, see. These old white guys, they wrote the Constitution, see. Well, years ago, I've written about 100 aphorisms, and one of the aphorisms that I came up with years ago in the 90s was, a living constitution can die, okay? And that's basically what we have today, is that there's been a transformation over decades, okay, and an attack on the Constitution, and what it plainly says, okay? I'm a strict constructionist of the Constitution. And so when I look at it, like the right to keep and bear arms, when I look, you know, at it in strictly what the Constitution says. Now, on the Second Amendment, they'll come back, yeah, but they'll say that's a well-regulated militia. Well, I had a thought about that. I started thinking about that one day. And so when the liberal comes up, or the person that's believing that the Constitution should change with the culture, which I don't believe, when they start giving you these arguments, especially about the Second Amendment, about this well-regulated militia that it states in there. Well, here's my response. Let's take a situation that I'm a militia member, okay? And I'm on my way to one of these state-regulated militia meetings and drills. And we're going to go there and clean our rifles and drill around and march around. And we're part of the state militia, the well-regulated state militia. But on the way to that meeting, I'm walking. It's not far away, say. I'm within walking distance of my home. I have my rifle slung over my shoulder with the muzzle down in very safe condition. I do have, a clip there with ammunition to take with me to the meeting. And let's just say that some thugs along the way try to rob me or try to beat me up or whatever and try to steal my weapon from me. Well, I can whip that thing out. I can put that cartridges in there, that magazine in there, and I can say, okay, buddies, you get out of here or you're going to die. Well, then the right to keep and bear arms has been transformed from a militia right, a collective militia right, to an individual right. So that's what I tell them. So the right to keep and bear arms has a collective and an individual right. And I'll tell you why. Because our founding fathers, they foresaw that someday our government could become real corrupt like it has become today. And they foresaw with wisdom that corrupt country, that government, excuse me, would need to be moved against, and it would start moving against its citizens and repress the citizens that wanted to criticize that very, very corrupt swamp that exists. And that when you start criticizing a very, very big government that we have today, well, that government's going to start coming after you, see, because they think that you're anti-government and that you don't really care about America, and that's how sometimes you're portrayed, see. But being unarmed, and is then you're defenseless from this monstrosity thing called big government, see. But if you and other Americans likewise are armed to the teeth, this repressive government's going to have a hard time dealing with you. And that's basically what we have to maintain in this country. Now, the liberals out there, I'm speaking to y'all too. I'm speaking to the people on the right and everyone in between. We need to continue to be well-armed in this country, but it's to protect ourselves from a repressive, destructive, mean-spirited government, big government. And I'm just afraid that we have this national security police state. It's already materialized in the form of all these different agencies that can do things to us. So that's why I say keep your arms, and to keep and bear arms, I think, is an American right, not only a collective right, but an individual right. We must awaken. Everybody talks about everybody's being asleep and stuff like that, and that gets to be an old saw, I know. But I'm working on a book now called Delusion, and I believe I understand what has been going on through this debasement of decades of debasement of the American system or the American ideals that have been debased. We have created, okay, a society, a community of people that are not happy, and we've had a family breakup that has occurred because of this debasement process. We've had alcoholism that is rife. And drugs have just taken over, and then now we've got prescription drugs that are, you know, taking over and dealing our citizens havoc and destruction. So decades after decades, we've had this slow, incremental debasement of the American way, the American system, the American principles. And what does it look like today? It looks like a very, very chaotic group of people out there that don't have morals, that don't believe in God, that will believe about anything. They're into the occult. They're into the practice of the occult sciences. And so that's basically what we're dealing with now with our young people. The idea that they can do anything they want and they can use these occult sciences to gain power, see. That's the fool's hustle, see. Our people are being hustled on multiple levels, see. And as this community broke up and was debased. You had the creationcy of a community, of a group, a society that was more emotionally based. And so the emotional appeals are much more powerful. And this is shown up, this is showing up in today's world, in the Alinsky model of rules for radicals, where Sal Alinsky put out the idea that you could start mobilizing some of the poor people in these communities, but they had to rile them up. They had to speak to their resentments and hatreds, and then they had to direct those resentments and hatreds against a target, say, to get their goals. Well, Obama and them and Hillary and them are utilizing the Alinsky model, but on a national basis. So they've taken that community of techniques of rallying up people and getting their resentments and hatreds, and they've taken that on a nationwide basis now. And that's coupled with the individual communities and societies being more emotionally based, upset. The communities, the people out there are more upset about things. They've been debased by alcohol, drugs, and so forth, and broken families. And they're mad as hell, but they don't know, you know, how they and why they get caught up in these movements. But these movements are led by people that are using them. So they become useful dupes because they continue to hate and resent, see. They become useful dupes for whoever is their leader, see. And then those useful dupes are going to be, they have been focused in today against Trump and these Republicans, and they're the problem, see. Or they can focus in on the word capitalism and make that just a general target, see. But these useful dupes that are being from the far left that are being focused and targeting the capitalistic system and the individuals there, they're not fully aware of crony capitalism. That's a real problem. Capitalism itself can be a panacea for small business people. But when you get into the scale that we have today, it has become monopolistic, or what we would classify or name or as crony capitalism. And that's what we're suffering from now, is a system dominated by large corporations who are funding the far left to bring about a transformation of America for the lower classes into national communism and world communism. And that's basically the way I see it. Look, I want to thank you for listening and being with us this evening. I want to thank Tony there. Tony gives us some excellent reports out of UK, and those are highly prized by us and myself. We get a different view, see, when someone lives there and they're British and they've lived there all their life, then you really get an insight that you can't get in any other way. And so I want to thank Tony. We have this UK thing, this Brexit. It could be that Theresa May was sabotaged and tricked into calling this snap election, which she should have never called, see. And in doing that, then it gave rise to a competition for the next prime ministership and which party would dominate this next government in the UK Parliament, the British Parliament. And that new, party dominating this British Parliament may not be that warm to Brexit, so it could be manipulated, and the British may not exit like some of the people over there want to. Well, I thank you very much for listening, and good night.